First I was a Catholic girl, loved the mass, I watched the swirl of smoke from candles burning, while Mary looked up yearning, I got confirmed.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO Radio 103.9 LPFM here in Knoxville, Tennessee. We're recording this on Sunday morning, December 10th, 2023. I'm Larry Rhodes, or DJ Doubter 5. And as usual, we have our co-host, Wombat, on the line with us. Hello, Wombat.
The Wombat. Oh, these arms are looking pretty good right now.
They are. Yeah, you got those guns ready there. And our special guest, Dread Pirate Higgs, welcome. Western Canada.
Digital.
Cool.
Nice.
Digital Free Thought Radio Hours, a talk radio show about atheism, free thought, rational thought, humanism, and the sciences. And conversely, we'll also talk about religions, religious faiths, Pastafarianism, gods, holy books, and superstition. And if you get the feeling that you're the only non-believer in your town, well, you're just not. Here in Knoxville, in the middle of the Bible Belt, we have a group of 1,100 of us. We're the Atheist Society of Knoxville, or ASK. And we'll tell you more about us after the mid-show break, so be sure to stick around. Wombat, what's our topic today?
I want to talk about pleading, but not just any kind of pleading.
Like
not
in
just,
court? Not court
yeah,
pleading?
No. This pleading is special. Very special. Special pleading, if you will. We're going to talk about it throughout the show today. And then if we have more time, we'll talk about legacies. I'll also go into listener comments today as well.
Cool.
Thank you guys so much for all your comments. Let's dump into some pleading, but before we go into that, I'd love to get into some pasta addictions. Or I'd be let through our pasta addiction by our own Dread Pirate Higgs. Go on ahead.
All right. Camera on. Our noodly nice. Lord, who art in a colander, al dente be thy noodles, thy blood be rum, thy sauce be yum. With meat, as it is with vegetables. Give us this day our garlic bread, and forgive us our cussing, as we forgive those who cuss against us. And lead us not into ketoism, but deliver us some carbs. For thine are the noodles, and the meatballs, and the grog, whenever and ever.
Ramen. I have noted that... I was playing disc golf this weekend, and I noted that someone was flying around with an FPV drone. I know it was an FPV drone because it was doing maneuvers through trees in a way where someone had to have seen the flight of the drone from the drone's perspective in order to navigate that well. Mm-hmm. I think they're filming like some video of like, hey, here's some paths that you can take. And I just want to like film myself play. I never found the pilot, but I did find the drone. And I thought to myself, wow, how cool it would be to fly like that through the woods, have that experience. But I also worry about the paranoia that people can have being seen play through what looks like a security camera on wings, right? But then I threw the idea up to like, you know, isn't that what the whole God is in a weird way? And my brain, my weird atheist brain, I have this weird thing where I can't keep thinking, I can't stop myself from reminding myself of all the contradictions in society, left and right. Every single time I see something like a security camera being like, and hearing people being like, we hate security cameras, but you love God looking at your actions every single day.
Right?
Yeah. And they're like, no, but that's different. Yeah. Right. I don't want to have that conversation with them. In my mind, it irks me when people aren't consistent with, you know, their rationale for what they prefer to have and what they don't prefer to have. Like, why can't we just have one criteria? Why are you making special excuses for yourself, or should I say
special pleadings? Yeah,
you know, that's how I define it, though. I wonder how everyone else would. Dread, would you like to give me a definition of how you define special pleading, maybe examples of that?
Yeah, well, you know, certainly you made a great case there. Is you know, for instance, I had a conversation recently with someone about supernatural stuff.
Yep.
And, you know, I pointed out that, you know, I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in you know, the Christian God. I don't believe in
angels,
Satan,
giants, witches, real magic tricks, etc.
And so and this person, of course, was agreeing with me for the most part, but then said, but I believe in ghosts. Ghosts are real.
Of all the things. So he doesn't believe.
Well, you know, it doesn't believe in all the other stuff, but, you know, makes a special case for ghosts because he saw one. Right.
Oh, and interesting.
It usually works that's what I find anyway. Another one is, you know, pseudoscience in medicine.
Yeah.
They don't believe in acupuncture. They don't believe in Reiki. They don't believe in all kinds of stuff, but chiropractic. Mm. They believe in chiropractic.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up.
That's a case of special pleading. Yeah.
Dredd, you may have to clarify what you mean by chiropractic, because we have a lot of listeners on the show, particularly in America, who aren't aware of what chiropractic is versus physical therapy. Would you mind just like highlighting the difference between the two? Because some people will be like, wait, I have a chiropractor.
So chiropractic was invented, I believe, in, it's not even 100 years old. But it was a guy that figured that some ailment bothering somebody was the result of what they call a subluxation in the spine. And so that doing an adjustment of the spine somehow remedied this affliction, and it just went crazy. People are just lapping this stuff up, and of course, chiropractics don't limit themselves anymore to just the back. They think they're, well, many of them practice or have broadened the spectrum of their, and you know, it doesn't take a lot of investigation to figure out just to what degree this is all a bunch of quackery. And it's been demonstrated over and over again. It's just unfortunate that so much of our, well, certainly in Canada, I don't know what it is in the States, but it's actually covered under medical.
Yeah.
So that, you know, people can go in and see chiropractors, and taxpayers are paying for the pseudoscientific discipline, if you want to call it that. But yeah, there you go.
It's sort of like being medically cleared to go see
chiropractor.
Yeah, it's like medically being cleared to go see an astrologist. You say, oh, I had a series of really bad headaches, and my doctor hears what I'm saying and says, you know what, you should probably go see Madame Divine at the at the psychic tundry next to the pawn shop and
the
laundry mat.
I think Mars is in the fourth house, and you know, and it's opposing the sun sign. Yes. Your planets are astray.
Yes. The weirdest, funniest thing, though, is how you can, after, as just human beings, if no one's ever went through the research to, or went through the effort to understand what chiropractic is, even watching like a YouTube video, like if you aren't looking for it, you won't find it. What you'll end up with is being in a culture where people will speak highly of visits that they've had to the chiropractor. People who mention it in passing without describing some of the issues with the science or the lack of, they'll just mention it as in, oh, I went to a doctor today, I checked out some chiropractors, and then I went to a dentist. Like in my head, I'm not having any alarms, but I, through just association, pulling these two things together and legitimizing it just by virtue of the fact that I'm not critically assessing what I'm paying attention to, because that takes effort. But the fact is that if someone made a case saying, hey, I went to a chiropractor and I had a really good time, and then after the fact had to realize, oh, wait a second, is this guy just pseudoscience? That's so much harder. That's so much of a harder barrier to go over, because now they've had that personal experience, like your friend who saw a ghost. Now they have to realize, well, then what did I experience? Was it actually a ghost, or was I hallucinating? What about all the times where I declared in public that I did see a ghost? Now I have to go back to my friends and like, by the way, I was wrong about the ghost thing, or go to my chiropractor and cancel my appointments. Right. And then realize it's just the fact that someone's touching you, giving you a lot of adrenaline and masking pain or symptoms temporarily, so that I walk out and then I feel good in the moment. But then the symptoms as a whole were not
placebo effect, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of growth.
And people, yes, And people are so, you know, they want to be confident in what their senses report to them. And, you know, so, you know, I saw it with my own eyes. Well, you know, there's probably circumstances where your eyes have definitely reported the wrong thing to you. And actually, I point out to some people, you know, who say they definitely saw a UFO or whatever. I say, hold a quarter at arm's length. That is called the fovea, and that is what your eye actually sees. Everything else is just filler. Your brain just fills in everything else. I said, you know, they, of course, they don't believe that. And I say, well, you know, you have an optic nerve, and that's called a blind spot. Do you see your blind spot? And they say, no. And I say, well, there you go. That's your brain filling in the
filling in along with that, like, can you see the bridge of your nose? Not when you're actually paying attention to your nose or not, right?
Missing.
And yeah, the main point here,
your brain does a lot to construction.
Right. The brain runs on input, and if it doesn't have any, it'll supply its own.
Though Larry and I have both seen UFOs, right? Larry, you've seen at least one UFO, right?
No.
I've seen UFOs. I saw one this weekend. Like, it's just an unidentified flying object.
Something
object,
that's flying that you can't identify. Yes.
Exactly. We saw a bright star. It looked like a star, but it was a cloudy night. We thought it was a blimp, you know, probably being like reflecting from some of the moonlight, but we didn't know. We thought either it was like some sort of blimp or like a very slow moving thing, maybe a satellite, maybe a man-made low orbit satellite. But unidentified flying objects exist. I think the repercussion that comes with it is when people start saying, I saw something I didn't understand, and it must be aliens or an angel or extra dimensional travelers. Like, that extra step from I don't know to, and this is my conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. That's the thing.
So, the leap of logic.
That's the part where special pleading starts to make it, it knock on the door and be like, hey, do you need an excuse to believe the thing that you believe in? I can help out with that. I was about to make an analogy that kids would not understand who watch our show. I think, you know, when a door-to-door vacuum salesman opens up your door and he throws a fistful of dirt onto your carpet, I don't know if that's ever happened to anybody, but that's happened to us once. That's happened to us once in America. Can you believe that? And then they'd be like, I can suck that up. I'm like, you just gave me the problem. Religion and macrocosm or microcosm. Larry, I would love to know, do you have examples of special pleading and how do you define it?
Well, it goes back to the existence of God. A lot of that is like, you know, nothing comes from nothing, right? Hmm. You can't get something from nothing. Well, where did God come from? Oh, he's always been here. You know, that's a special pleading. You know, that he never had a beginning. Okay, well, you're just making up
Now we have an example.
Right.
Yeah, now we have an example of something that doesn't come from anything.
Yeah. And also, you know, God made everything. Well, God made evil then. Oh, no, the devil made evil. Yeah, so it's an exception to the general rule that goes flying in the face of the general rule, but they claim it anyway. It's special pleading.
So exactly, that's a really good point.
William Lane Craig uses that argument a lot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Logically, if you say
the Kalam cosmological argument.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Dredd. I'll continue. So, Dredd, if you had logically set up an argument for why God needs to exist by saying everything has to come from something, right? And my head, I hear that, I think, okay, all right. So far, as a first statement, I can understand what you're talking about. Okay, now let's talk about God. Where did he come from? Well, he doesn't count.
Right. What did he make the universe out of? You know, like, since there was nothing around, nothing but him.
And, you know, even if you were to follow that argument from in the explicit order for how things are created, like God created light first thing, and he said it was good. In my mind, light works. Light works by bouncing off of things and bouncing back into your receptor, right? Like, so you mm-hmm. can see something. A light source exists, photons are emitted, they bounce off a physical object or something that has mass that I can interact with. Those photons bounce off that substance and they go into my detectors, my eye detectors and I can see things. That's how light works. If light was the first thing to exist and it was good, how did you know it even existed? Because otherwise, it's like me shining a flashlight into deep space. That light's just going to keep going and never going to come back to me. It's going to be effectively as dark. It will be just as dark right. as if there was no light at all. So what was the point of that being the first step? What if there was nothing else preceding that?
Nothing else to reflect off of.
Yeah. It's one of the weird follies of, oh, this is written by a person who doesn't understand physics or light, right? And if you go to a physicist and you say, hey, if I don't have anything and I shine light on it, will it bounce off anything? It's like, no, because that's not how light works. It's like, great. So chapter one of the Bible, first line, more or less. He's like, well, that doesn't count. If I'm a Christian physicist, I'd be like, well, here's the exception to the rules, because maybe there was miasma. It's like
anything to make it work. Created. Yeah.
Yeah. Post ad hoc rationalizations are really, really frustrating to hear from an atheist point of view. Larry, more on the idea of special pleading. How could I recognize, even as an atheist, if I'm operating under special pleading?
Just be honest with yourself. If you make some contradictory statement, you may not recognize it yourself because you were raised with it. But when somebody tells you about it, recognize the truth in what they tell you and don't just try to push it away from you mentally. You know, in other words, think about your beliefs, especially if somebody brings up the problem with those beliefs. Don't just blow them away. Think about them. Try to see how you might be wrong in this particular situation. It doesn't mean the whole thing's wrong. Just think about that one thing and go from there.
Yeah. And don't worry about, here's my thought. Don't worry so much about needing to change your conclusion, right? Because if you put so much, your belief or your confidence in the conclusion will adjust once you start caring about how you got to your conclusion. So you don't have to worry about like, oh, do I have to believe something different? It's like, no, you just need to start caring about how you approach beliefs.
Right. Your method is crucial.
Yes. When you start thinking about what your sources are, how you're coming to arrive at such high levels of confidence, when you start putting investment into that, everything that comes downstream of that will be improved. And if you want that to still be, well, I still want to believe in a God, at least you'll come to a more rational level of why you believe in that God, which is totally fine. I want people to have more rational ways to get their conclusions.
The one thing I can respect is if somebody says they believe in God and I ask them why, common question, why? You know, they'll say, because I want to. Well, that's honesty. that's honesty. I can respect that. Yeah. Okay, fine. You know, a lot of people want to believe in UFOs and Bigfoot and leprechauns, you know. At least you're being honest.
I believe in UFOs. Are you telling me weird? Am I special pleading right now?
Not as long as you understand that they are just unidentified flying objects.
That's exactly what they are.
I don't think that's hypocritical or special pleading at all.
No, I think though, if I went to a convention for UFO con, people would be really upset if that's all I said they were. They'd be like, no, you have to go. You have to buy the whole horse and carriage.
I'm sure there's some that represent both camps there.
Okay. Let me try to think about one more thing on special pleading that I do note. For myself, I really do care about why I believe things, right? And so as Larry had mentioned, it's really important for you to think about the beliefs that I have. If you could, if you're watching the show, maybe jot down like what are the five most important beliefs that I have, right? And like those can be the things that you do believe. But then right next to them, think about like why you believe them, how you got to those conclusions. And then what I want you to do is take, if you have these two pillars, right? You have the things that you believe and then you have why you believe them. Take that section of what you believe and literally, okay, take why you believe and cover it up, right? And then replace the things that you do believe with five different but analogous things. So like if I said, I believe in the Christian God, now I'm going to replace it with Muslim God or God from Islam or Jade or some other God. And then look at those reasonings again. Do any of those reasonings apply to that God that you believe in? If you say, hey, I'm the coolest person in school, and my reason is because I have these fancy pants. If someone else had the fancy pants, would that person be the coolest person in school? Like does the reasons that you have specifically and necessarily support that God belief that you have? A good example that I have of this is I've done this practice with someone, and they said, well, I believe that the sun is my God because it sustains life. These are the reasons it sustains life. And without it, I wouldn't exist, or life would cease to exist on Earth. And that's why it's a God to me. And so the follow-up that I had to him is, well, you know, we had some examples where, let's just replace it with no sun. If the sun stopped existing, or if the sun was like two suns and there's like twice as much sunlight, we know, or if we weren't worshiping the sun, we were worshiping planet Mercury or something like that. The main conclusion was, we have planets that clearly have more sunlight than Earth, like Mercury or Venus. They're exposed to more solar radiation, and there's no life being sustained. And in fact, it's almost as if UV light is antagonistic to life in general. Not only that, but we also know that if the sun were to go away, there's life on Earth that never even exposes itself to sunlight, like deep water fish that are insulated by layers and layers of ocean water, right? And maybe even ice on top of that. So it seems like, for the reasonings that you position for why the sun is a god, the sustainment of life through sunlight isn't necessarily a feature. It's just seems to be more like a byproduct of just enough sunlight and just really an atmosphere to filter out a lot of the UV. And that even if the sun was gone, we'd still have life on Earth. So what about these reasonings tie back to the sun being God? And I literally, this is the end of the conversation was, well, you know what? That's actually pretty good. Maybe I should not have the sun be my God and think more about how the atmosphere sustains life. Because without that, then it seems like the life on Earth would go away a lot faster. It's like, yeah, that would be at least an improvement, right? Because now he's thinking about his beliefs and he sees that his conclusions are changing. Yeah. I'd love to just see more people think about their beliefs in that way, just like in a formatted, thoughtful consideration, particularly if it's important to them.
Well, we were talking about methods, and the method is all important to approach the truth. If you've got a faulty method, you're going to get faulty answers. And that's why we rely so much on the scientific method. It's self-correcting. If a scientist comes up and says, hey, I've got this theory and here's my work, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to send it out for peer review, and all of the people who have the same degrees that he does going to look at it and try to understand it and replicate it. And if there's flaws in it, he will be the first to be notified over it. And especially if it's a long-standing theory, like a theory of evolution or something, and even gravity, which is still being challenged to this date. And if somebody comes up with an exception to that that disproves it, that person, the scientific community, will make that person famous and rich because they want to know the truth above all else. I have another example of special pleading if you'd like to hear it.
Yes, please.
When I'm out talking to people, you know, in my little Asking Atheist booth, they come over and one of the first things some of them want me to do is disprove their God. Because how can I not believe in their God if I have no evidence against their God? You know, disprove it. Instead of, you know, taking the onus, the responsibility of proving that their own God exists, that they say it exists and has, you know, you would think the onus of proof would be on the person
it is
owning the claim. Now, but to think the special pleading part of it is they disbelieve in all the other religions' gods. And never try to disprove them. Never try to come up with evidence against it. So they can demand that we disprove it, but their special pleading is, oh, I don't have to, you do.
Right. You know, right. Because by default, people are Christian because they were Christian before they even were aware that there are other options, right?
In a Christian family, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's scary. When you change your default, then it seems like the burden belongs to everybody else because you're living a default naturalistic life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's both. And I'll throw this as our closing comment. It is both a fault of the human condition and society in general that the things that we get used to, we take for granted, whether they're good things or bad things. If you're a very talented writer, if you keep writing, eventually you'll feel like I'm not that good of a writer, even though you might be really good. If you're a great artist and you keep putting beautiful pieces of art out, eventually you'll start feeling like my art's not as good. And so it's good to get reminders that you are a quality person, you are a quality writer, you are a good person. But for even thoughts or indoctrinated thoughts that were given to you, like Christianity, or if you grew up in an Islam family, you start to think, oh, this is my fundamental way of looking at the world, and everybody else who just doesn't fall into my dogma, they're wrong. That could be just as alarming, particularly when you start getting to an age where you start realizing, I don't feel as good of a person anymore because I believe in my God. Now I'm stuck in this loop where I'm constantly trying to reinforce my religious beliefs, not just on myself, but on other people, to reinforce the feeling of adequacy that I used to get out of my religion, even though it is ultimately just a position on false hope, right? And that could be a spiral for a lot of people who are caught in a loop where they're just constantly trying to prove to their God that doesn't answer to them, doesn't talk to them, doesn't have any relationship with them on a tangible level, that they are in fact a good person, are worthy of love, and are worthy of respect and authority.
Which goes directly against the basic teaching of Christianity. You're not worthy. You were born in sin. You're nothing without Jesus.
Yeah, it's a noxious poison that you can systematically keep giving yourself, that you can get used to for a period of time, but I think long-wise cause a lot of harm overall. So it's really important that we recognize where we are, understand what special pleading is. And if you are listening to this and you are religious, think about, you know, if you are looking for a way out, you know, contact people who's your local atheist so that you can, or at least, you know, start going on some YouTube channels to figure out how to get yourself free from like bad loops of thoughts. Dredd, any final thoughts before we break?
Well, you can also get in contact with your local Pastafarian.
Really? Pastafarians will help you out for that? Okay, I didn't know this.
Well, I'll tell you, and I'll tell you why, or I can tell you after the break.
Tell us after the break. I'd love to know this, because I wonder if this is another case of special pleading. Let's just get to the break.
All right. Well, this is the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO Radio, 103.9 LPFM here in Knoxville, Tennessee. And we'll be right back after this short break.
Hell, hell, I want to go to hell. It seems a really fun place to play. But I got to do what's right and do it every day if I want to go to hell someday.
Welcome back to the second half of the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour. I'm Doubter 5, and we're on WOZO Radio 103.9 LPFM here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Let's just take a moment to talk about the Atheist Society of Knoxville. ASK was founded in 2002. We're in our 21st year now and have 1,100 members. We have weekly in-person meetings every Tuesday evening in Knoxville's Old City at Barley's Tap Room and Pizzeria. Look for us inside at the high top tables or if it's pretty weather outside on the deck. You can find us online on Facebook, meetup.com, or go to our website at knoxvilleatheist.org. It's just that simple. By the way, if you don't live in Knoxville, you should go to Meetup and do a search for an atheist group in your town. Don't find one. Start one.
Start one.
Wombat, where do you want to pick up?
I want to talk about special pleading. So it turns out that Dredd said that if you are stuck in a belief where you are worshiping a God that you a God of nebulous existence, that you should reach out to a Pastafarian to hopefully help out with what? This is interesting now, because what do you got, Dredd?
So we distinguish ourselves in the following way, that our religion is as likely to be true as any other.
It's pretty good.
So, well, it's a start, right? I mean, you know, other religions, of course, and even the Abrahamic religions, like if you're Jewish, you believe in the same God as Christians and Muslims do, but they're all still mutually exclusive. Certainly, if you're a Sikh, everyone else is wrong. If you're a Hindu, everyone else is wrong. If you're a Jew, everyone else is wrong. Pastafarians don't take that stance. We just say we are as likely to be true as any of the other religions in the world that have been, are, or will be. Hmm. And so we eliminate special pleading in the sense that we don't claim exclusivity to truth, or knowledge of the underlying nature of the universe. We just say, it may be true, it may be not. We don't really care, but it's something we're into right now. So there you go.
That's cool. I understand that. Ramen. Yeah, I understand the idea of like, hey, by us, so we're not supplanting your religious view of a monotheistic deity or even polytheistic deity with another one. What we're basically saying is we have a more open-minded option that's open to swing.
That's right.
Which is just as likely to be true. Like
it goes right back to the God back guarantee. Like, try us out for 3 months, and if you don't like us, your old God will probably take you back.
Right.
God back guarantee.
It's the
That's cool.
Yeah. The George Carlin Joe Pesci rule, where it's, hey, I'm just going to start praying to Joe Pesci for the next couple of years, and we'll see if anything changes. And if not, I'm just going to keep sticking with that. I was thinking about something this week. As we get older, we think about what's more important. Like, is it my body? Is it the good things that I can leave behind, the numbers in my bank account? And what I realized was, and I was alluding to this last week, is that I really do care about the legacy. The legacy that I have is very important to me. And the reason why I bring that up is because I know my body is temporary, but I could have a lasting impact that lasts longer than my temporal form, my mortal coil, if you will. And what I mean by that is the good things that I do, the people that I make, the things that I can teach, the discoveries in science that I can establish, the work that I can put forward and move industry through analytical research, support, just putting out good vibes. Like, even if I snapped my fingers and I disappeared today, I think those would have a positive lasting impact that I could say that I was happy to contribute to and pioneer for. That's very important for me. And I feel like if you were going to open up a book about Tyrone Wells, if I was fortunate enough to have something like that about 100 years from now, what they look back on isn't what I did yesterday when I woke up, brushed my teeth, took a shower, and just like fed my cat and like all these mundane activities that I did. What I hope is that they can see a lasting impact of, wow, really good, strong, positive influences in science, good support in the community, like good standards for safety in our laboratories. People got to go home safe, come to work in the same state that they did when they left. Everybody was like very positive with the amount of work that was being put out and the productivity they put up, picking up trash, helping the hungry, walking dogs on the weekend, a volunteer show. Like, this guy did a lot of cool things, and the good things are still around, and more people are motivated to do them by virtue of the fact that this guy participated in it. Like, that's the culture that I want to be able to stimulate. What I look back on when I look back on historical figures, what I realize is, a lot of times we're not talking about that person specifically. We're talking about the legacy that they put out, because we will put people on pedestals, historical figures, even Ben Franklin. I don't know, George Washington. I'm trying to come up with a Canadian historical figure, but my American history is not very good. Okay. My American history is just so U.S. centric. But when you look back on those figures in detail, you actually realize Ben Franklin was actually kind of a terrible person. George Washington, slave owner, like, not a, when he's fighting for freedom, he's not talking about women. Like, the people that we have on like the Mount Rushmore is largely made by people who are looked like and could fund a Mount Rushmore. In fact, Roosevelt is on that monument because he paid for it with taxpayer money. So it's just this weird echo chamber of people patting themselves on the back. And as far as like a legacy is concerned, we can look at it and visit and be like, wow, Americana, wow, this great historical impact. But who are those people in general? And now I wonder about religious figures. We think we know a lot about Jesus. We think we know a lot about Moses and Isaac and Abraham and all these other figures. But do we really know anything about them? Or do we just understand a legacy that they still have as an impact on society? And is that legacy and is that impact positive? Or if it, or under microscope, is it actually far more noxious, far worse than we could have ever imagined? And if I were to think of like the impact that Jesus has had on society overall, I can't think of one person who's been responsible for more deaths in human history than that person, or the inhibition of science, or support of ignorance, or family conflict, or, you know, just prejudice in general. from just one person's legacy. Maybe that guy didn't even know what he was about to do, if there was a collection of different people put together, but that legacy has a lasting impact that I find to be a net negative, actually. So if so, that's a strong, what do you think, Dredd? Is that fair to say?
I was going to say that often, I mean, certainly people, most people, I think, don't set out with the notion that they're creating a legacy, that they're just acting according to their own temperament, their own personality, their own motivations, and their temporary goals. And that after the fact, if they've had an impact on society, it's the constructed narrative after the fact that makes a legacy. And, you know, you brought up Jesus, and certainly what he was saying at the time when he was alive and doing his ministry wasn't really the legacy, because that's what Paul created. Paul created the true legacy of Jesus, which is, you know, Gentiles are, you know, can be saved and all the rest of it. And like I've listened to Bart Ehrman, this New Testament scholar, and some real deep dives into this stuff, and it's very surprising the different messages that Paul had with respect to Jesus' teachings, and what Jesus had to say right out of his own mouth. So that's what I mean by legacy being a constructed narrative, usually. After the fact, you know, like George Washington and all, you know, those guys, they were all acting as members of their time, right? And, you know, trying to do what their temperaments and motivations and all the rest of it guided them to do. But, you know, people embellish stories after the fact, and all of a sudden, you know, you have these people that, could not possibly be as good as history remembers them.
Right. And I wonder, is that a fair representation of them? Would that be something they'd even recognize? Or would they say, man, I died twice, once in actuality and two in the minds of everybody, as you replace me with this mascot who has my same face and name and purports ideals that I didn't even support at the end of the day. Larry, I wonder... questions of legacy. Do you feel like the lasting impact of Jesus on society has been a positive or a negative legacy? If that's a fair question, if not, feel free to open it.
To be fair, he had some good things to say about equality, or not even equality, but if you're with sin, be the first to cast a stone, you know, that type of thing. But it was far outweighed by all the negative stuff that he supported. Now, the first thing that he did, which was a problem and brought a lot of harm into his new religion, was he supported and validated the Old Testament. You know, not one jot and tittle of the Old Testament law will pass away. So he brought all of that baggage into his new message of hope.
I agree.
And also, he was the one who created hell, and there was no hell before, no eternal punishment before the New Testament. So, I mean, that's a whole big bunch of problems and harm that he created for us right there. Now, that's himself and his own legacy. But then religions, of course, you know, are things like, they grow up from those, and they differ and they split, and they have 13,000 different denominations. Now, if you disagree with a scientist, you are either right or wrong, and you can prove it. If you disagree with the church, you just start a new church, and that's how they splinter and move on.
Sure, but, right across the street from each other sometimes.
And, you know, that's where you get into it. It splits mankind into warring factions, and that's another huge problem that he brought to the world.
Dredd, Larry, you completely overlooked the biggest thing that Jesus ever did, which was destroy that fig tree. Like, he's like, hey, someone else's fig tree. Oh, there's no figs in it. You're gone. And some guy's like, hey, that's my fig tree.
And it was out of season, too.
What are you doing? You can't just do that. It's like, I hated that tree. It didn't have a fig for me. It's like, even if it did and they weren't for you, that was my fig tree. What are you doing?
Right. All right, he's destroying personal property.
Right. Trent, I see
he's
you.
What's vandal. Up? He's a vandal.
He's a vandal.
But he's the ultimate salesman, right? Because like you point out, Larry, there was no hell. So he creates hell and then puts himself forward as the solution to that problem.
Yes.
Right? It's right. like yes. any mm-hmm. product, you know, they create the problem and then say, and we, as it turns out, have the solution by me, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, it was almost as if it was missing a component, because the situation was, you're a sinner. And that was, you know, Old Testament. What's the repercussion of being a sinner? God doesn't like you that much. I was like, okay. Is that it? More or less? It's like, yeah, it's fine. Then Jesus is like, by the way, if you're a sinner, internal damnation. You're like, oh, now that's a problem. So what's the solution? Jesus also. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, in the Old Testament, they could just do animal sacrifice, you know, and get back in good with God. But in the future,
if you're a landowner and if you own property that you can destroy for no other purpose, not to feed your family or anything like that, if you had, what is it, dispensable income, yes, then you can save yourself, which makes it very clear what kind of status or caste Old Testament was supporting, right?
Right.
Like if you have property to destroy, then yeah, you can be saved. Everybody else, sorry. Get some goats and burn them in this exact same way with some furnace and all that other stuff.
Well, and there's another case of special pleading is this idea of animal sacrifice being something that was pleasing to the Lord. Nobody in modern society, I don't think, would consider trying to rationalize that in any way, or seeing that as a a reasonable part of their own history, right? Like moving forward, why would you believe in a God now that used to be pleased by the killing of animals and the burning of their flesh? That's pretty bizarre.
With the New Testament, you don't have to do that anymore because Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice.
However, I understand. I'm just saying that again is, you know, sort of a special pleading to excuse the behavior of a right. God who demanded right. that in the first place.
Right. I was just going to say, however, you know, even though Jesus did sacrifice himself and replace all the other sacrifices, you're still a sinner. You know, you're still damned to hell unless you follow that particular church's doctrine about accepting Jesus and tithing and following the religion.
Yes, very true. I also wonder, so I have a mom who loves me very much, and she's a Jehovah's Witness, and she will send me brochure. Well, she will ask now before she sends me brochures for Jehovah, right? And she'll call me on the phone, and if that conversation ever gets to religion, she knows I'm an atheist. She's supportive of that, which is really big on her. But she'll say, "Ty, I have brochures. Would you like to see one for, you know, Watchtower or the Truth, etc." And I made the point. I don't know the exact wording, but I said basically, "Mom, if I sent you a brochure for Allah, would that?" You would agree that you would need more than a brochure to believe in Allah, right? And she's like, yeah, of course. I'd need more than a brochure to believe in more or less any other God, except for my one God.
That's special pleading right there.
Yeah, and that's an example of special pleading. I can label it, but it doesn't have the impact until you understand the importance of caring about why you believe things, right? Right. And I think that's the justified point. As atheists, we are very quick to point out the logical flaws and errors, but they fall on deaf ears if we're talking to people who don't care if their beliefs are true and just care about what they believe and not why they believe it. And it's really up to us, honestly, to transition from and there's still a place for it. I think in like public debates, I think it's a really good place, but transition from attacking the conclusion or pointing out the errors and more of inspiring people to critically assess why they arrived at their conclusions. We can do that in a multitude of different ways, but that's the key to getting people to start thinking about this stuff and having a higher standard of evidence. I think another problem too, and I'm going to get in my old person soapbox, but I think we are living in a culture where less and less so we are afraid to tell people that they're wrong. I knew when I was a kid. Yes. I hear Dredd and Larry nodding their head so hard. When I was a kid, when I was wrong, my teacher would just be like, that's wrong. They wouldn't say incorrect. Like, they'd be like, that's wrong. And I'd be like, oh, I'm wrong. I have to get right. I have to figure out how to fix this. Then like around like high school, it was like, well, you're incorrect. And I was like, huh, that's weird, because I know I'm wrong. But I'm not correct. So like, what else would that leave? But wrong. And then I think like around college, like I would say things that I almost knew were not right, or at least were tenuous at best. And people would be like, well, it's a difference of opinion, right? And I'm like, how can that be? It's a binary yes or no situation, black white situation. Like, I've made it either X or not X. Like, it's a true dichotomy. How can it be a difference of opinion? Like, that's something that I'd like to investigate more. And then as my adulthood continued, I realized that it wasn't just me. I feel like culturally, at least as far as America goes, we've been more concerned with not letting people know that you are wrong on things, to the point where with people who have access to the internet are now very confident about the rabbit holes they've fallen in, and the cropping of other opinions to have a perfectly catered point of view to that fits their ideals, their dogmatic thinking, their closed-mindedness. And so when they are express an opinion that's flatly wrong, I had a guy literally tell me, well, all Asians wear glasses. I said, that's wrong. And he was offended. Like, I heard him. I was like, well, I what do you mean? That's not even what I just said. It's like, literally, you just said all Asians wear glasses. Like, what's the problem with that? It's like, I'm literally telling you the idea is wrong. Like, you said a wrong thing that's factually incorrect. Like what way can I make this where your opinion personally isn't you, and you can rectify that situation? Because
what was your method at arriving at that information?
Yeah, so like, we need to culturally get used to the idea that being wrong is a good thing, because then you can understand how to be right. Understanding that you don't know something is a good thing, because that's how you can start your journey to start learning new things. Like, it's not just about being correct from beginning to end. That's a boring life. Like, the scientific method, the process of discovery, the exciting thing about learning stuff is that you realize that you are wrong on certain things and you have an opportunity to fix it. Without that, I don't feel like you're living to your true standard. And it doesn't work until you realize what being wrong is and understanding and valuing that. That's the measure of doubt. That's the value of understanding that we're in a world where we can learn new things. And that's my purpose in life. That's hopefully a legacy that I can give to other people. Dredd, I see your hand up. What's up?
Just to say that truth and facts are not subjective.
Right. Yes.
That there is an objective reality, and it's not just about how I feel about it.
Yes.
And this is where I think our culture has taken a bit of a spin, is people are believing that it's true for me.
Yeah.
No. It's not true for you. It's true or it isn't true, independent of whether you exist or not. And that's what people have to get their sloppy brains around.
Okay. All right. And special pleading is a good way to recognize that. The way how I think about it is special pleading. It's wrapping paper. It's wrapping paper, but it's scratch and sniff wrapping paper that smells like dog poop, right? And my opinion is, you can special plead around a good conclusion. Like, I can wrap gift wrap paper around something that I actually want. But the question is why would I do that? Why would I give someone a gift of special pleading wrapped good ideas when they have that idea and they think, oh, it's sticky and it smells like dog poop? Why would you wrap up a good idea with this? It didn't need it. Get rid of it. Maybe find a better wrapping paper for it, or no wrapping paper at all. Good ideas. Truth doesn't need any frosting on top of it. You know, like, just give me the truth. That's really all I need. All special pleading does is get in the way.
I can understand the need for having a reason. Now, you know, you don't have a reason, so you make something up that sounds reasonable to you. It's stinky and it's a false wrapping paper, but it's a reason. I can understand and see them doing that. It's just a human need, you know?
Yeah. That's a very good point.
The only reason you should ever wrap dog poop is to have something to light on fire at somebody's doorstep, right?
Right.
Only on Halloween. Right.
Larry, you alluded to a really good point, because I can put wrapping paper around an empty box, and now that empty box suddenly has so much more value. It looks very tantalizing, but it's still an empty box.
Right.
So that's another danger with special pleading. Yeah. I can completely wrap it around things that don't even exist, or a complete waste of time or space, or just things that take up space but have no merit, tensile strength, or something to support it with in the time of need. Yeah. And how many of my ideas are basically just specialty wrapped papers? Just because I'm an atheist doesn't mean that I'm prone or not prone to fooling myself on some good ideas. There's some things that I really need to adjust.
An example, you know, a guy lives in Africa and he has little kids, and the kids say, why do giraffes have such long necks? And you don't know the answer. But you say, oh, well, so they can reach the highest limbs and get the juicy leaves up there, so their necks, you know, have over time stretched to get there. That's the wrong answer. But it gave him something to pass on. He had a reason that he could fall back on, it, even though it was wrong.
Right. It's very true. I want to throw out one random story before we close. And I do feel...
Oh, don't forget our customer.
Yes.
Listener comments.
Good point. So we did get a listener comment. This one's from Mudahar. Mudahar, I believe, the name. And he or she said, what is your criteria? If you guys claim, I'm trying to make it YouTube friendly. Basically, you're saying, this is from our last show that we posted. Actually, it's not from our last show. This is from the show, It's All in Your Head. That's from 2 weeks ago. And they refer to, well, what's your criteria? And I imagine they're referencing, well, if you said something was morally good or morally not good, as atheists, what do you determine as a good way to determine what is morally good or morally not if you don't believe in God? So what's your criteria? I'll throw it up to you, Larry.
Oh, well, mine is pretty easy. It's harm. If it does no harm, it's morally ambiguous. If it helps the person or society or whatever, then it's good morality. And if it harms people financially, emotionally, physically, whatever, then it's negative morality. But really, all you really need to have is compassion and empathy for your fellow man. If you have that, it'll take you 9/10 of the way to a good moral standard of your own.
Yeah. And mine is a bit Kantian. So like, I don't have a short answer. My idea is, my preference is, I don't know. Right. But I have models that I find to be very reliable. And until then, I'm willing to listen to other models and then assess them on their ability to maximize well-being and reduce needless harm.
Right.
And I will listen to the models, and I'll try to apply that strategy to them. And based on how well they do those two things, maximize well-being and minimize needless harm, then I'll replace whatever model I have with that next more better improved model. And right now I have a model that's pretty good, can always be improved, and is constantly learning and self-correcting. And I like to think of morality less of a list of edicts and a set of rules, and more of an evolving system based on social contracts that we develop, and science, and a better understanding of the consequences of my action. And I understand that that's a longer answer than just whatever God said. But the problem with that is it's not as comprehensive for a lot of the more nuanced problems that can come up in life. Whereas I feel like mine's a much more multifaceted approach to learning how to be a better person rather than just following a bunch of rules that I'm trying to be obedient to. Dredd, what's your response?
I was going to say that I almost take a Bayesian approach, that you keep updating your priors. You start with the premise that you want to accentuate human flourishing and, as you say, reduce harm. Mm-hmm. But your actions always have to be amenable to updates so that, you know, we continually look to expand our moral, you know, they improve our moral choices. And that's by updating our priors with new evidence and new information. And we have, because, you know, in contrast, getting your morality from a book or from a God is, that's it. I mean, he's spoken, and there's no changing the law, as it were. But taking a Bayesian approach, at least you're updating your priors and leaving yourself open to improvement.
I like the Bayesian approach. I also like the Kantian approach because it separates moral actions from necessarily what I should do or what I need to do. It just makes this new category of oughts, which is, hey,
you're talking about David Hume.
Is that not Kant?
No, that's Hume.
Okay. Categorical imperative doesn't refer to what you ought to do and what you shouldn't do in making methods of determining.
Well, so the categorical imperative was Kant.
Yes.
But, the ought and is thing was Hume.
Okay, so was Kant just informed by Hume's book and then put it into Kant and into his work?
Well, Kant was before Hume.
Okay. I'm referring to the example that Kant came up with, which is like the axe murder at someone's door, right? Is that Hume? Are you saying that's Hume?
I'm not familiar with the axe murder. Sorry.
So Kant came up with the example of there's an axe murder at your door. Should you open up? And the axe murderer says, I'm going to kill the person, your wife. And it's up to you to determine whether or not you should open up the door or lie to him and say, no, my wife's not here, go away. Because if you'd lie to him, he'll walk away. But he then said, morally, you shouldn't lie, right? So morally, you shouldn't lie, but you still shouldn't, you ought not lie, but you still shouldn't open up the door. Like, you can come up with completely different metrics to determine what you ought to do morally versus what you should do practically. The overall takeaway that I had from reading it, and this thing is much more complicated, it's a more nuanced level of understanding morality versus what you should do. And the value of it is you can use morality as sort of like an objective measuring stick and just say, that seemed to be the most moral course of action, but let's see what they actually did and look at the consequences left and right from a more distance point of view. I appreciate the idea that you can look at things a bit more dispassionately rather than just saying, well, I did because I had to do it. It's like, well, let's find out what you actually did and see if we can improve it. Because a lot of people would, for example, I see Larry. Well, a lot of people jump into like water to save somebody, but it actually turns out the fact that if you try to save a drowning person, jumping in to save them is like one of the worst things you could do because they'll grab you and you'll be pulled down too. Maybe you can get a life raft or something like that.
There's an experiment, stuff like that. Experiment out there. I don't have time to go into it right now, but the listener should look up the trolley experiment. Mm. The trolley experiment for morality. It's very good reading and a short film that will explain a lot how difficult true morality is to come by.
Cool. Yeah. All right. That's the show. Dredd, anything you'd like to plug for next week?
I'll have to give it some thought.
Okay. For me, I would say, don't be scared if you see drones. You're already being viewed by multiple security cameras and left
and right. Don't worry about getting vaccinated because you're already getting tracked on your phone.
I would say for anyone who has a smartphone but doesn't want to get vaccinated, like you have your priorities completely out of order. But yes. Larry, anything that you'd like to say?
And remember, God is always watching.
Yes, and God is always watching. What's your problem?
Always under surveillance.
Yeah.
You can find the show on podcasts everywhere. Just search for Digital Free Thought Radio Hour. If you're watching this on YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe. If you're having trouble leaving religious beliefs behind, you can get help at recoveringfromreligion.org. My content can be found at digitalfreethought.com. Be sure to click on the blog button for more radio show archives, atheist songs, and many articles on the subject. I have a book, it's Atheism, What's It All About, on Amazon. And my YouTube channel handle is at Doubter5. Remember, everybody is going to somebody else's hell. The time to worry about it is when they prove that heavens and hells and souls are real. Until then, don't sweat it. Enjoy your life. And we'll see you next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock here on WOZO Radio Knoxville. Say bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Buddy.